Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome back to Inside the Hive. This is Emily Jane Fox, and I'm here with a very, very special guest. I'm here with Professor Andy Tucker, a historian and journalist who has taught at Columbia Journalism School, my former alma mater. Since 1998, she has been writing on the evolution of conventions of truth-telling for decades, and she is the author of a new book that is just absolutely fantastic. I read it last night. The book is called Not Exactly Lying, Fake News and Fake Journalism in American History. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Your book feels like it could not be more timely. This is the topic that Joe and I talk about all the time on this podcast. It is the topic of any smart person having any kind of conversation in the world right now. But you are kind of the original when we're talking about fake news and fake journalism. You were writing about it and studying it long before anyone who ever had an inkling in their eye about Trump being president and Fox News being Fox News ever thought about anything that they're doing right now. So how and why did you start looking and studying fake news and fake journalism in American history?
You're right. I did begin this a long time ago. I started when I was writing my dissertation. I was interested in figuring out how people talk about what is true and how people determine the language that persuades other people that things are true. Journalism was obviously an arena to consider that. But it also became really clear really fast that you can't talk about conventions for telling the truth without also understanding the reasons and the conventions and the responses about what's false. So they go together. And the more I studied journalism over the years, the more often I would see it's filled with hoaxes, it's filled with humbugs, it's filled with mistakes, it's filled with deceptions. It's also filled with some really great stuff, and they fight. And how truth wins out has always been an interest, and also how truth doesn't always win out has been a sideline.
Well, what is the difference? Is it a matter of timing? Is it a matter of specific circumstances prevailing? What are the times when truth has prevailed? And what are the times when they haven't? Like, what is the difference that is happening? What's the alchemy that is being struck at that point?
Alchemy, that's an interesting word. So much of it depends on the political and social and cultural atmosphere of the time. It's really, really hard to tell straightforward, difficult truths in times of war, for instance. And we're seeing that with Ukraine, certainly. There's a lot of misinformation for propaganda purposes. There's also a lot of pressure to tell the good news on the right side. There was the example of the fighter ace, the Ukrainian fighter ace, who was supposedly shooting down Russian pilots right and left. And this took over social media. And it turned out that it was actually fabricated from a video game, the footage that was used to tell this story. Because it's so tempting to want to tell good news in a time of crisis. Sure. That's always the era of greatest tension. Technologies, though, new technologies come along, and the first thing people think is, wow, this is really great. This is going to change everything. How are we going to use this? And then the next thing that comes along is people think, how do we tell what's true in this new thing that doesn't have any rules anymore yet? So those are the kind of inflection points that really need attention when we're thinking about truth and falsehood.
Well, what's interesting in hearing you say this and then in reading your book, it feels like the times when people are both most susceptible to believing things that are maybe not entirely true and also when people are pushing things that are not entirely true are in times of great strife and when there's something to gain by pushing a specific side. Does that ring true to you?
Yes, okay. Yes, something to gain. And often what that is political power. And that's a lot of what we're seeing nowadays with the hyper-partisanship. There have been other eras of hyper-partisanship before where fake news and fake journalism have flourished, like the Clinton years with the whole Arkansas project of a billionaire funding a right-wing magazine to dig up dirt on the Clintons, most of which was aspirational or never proven. But it both feeds and is fed by these moments of intense political infighting and grappling for power.
You just struck on something. You said both fake news and fake journalism. And I'm wondering if you could explain the distinction between the two of those.
Yeah, that's a distinction that I make in the book. Fake news, we all know, we hear fake news. It's become just ubiquitous in the public discourse. Everything you don't like is called fake news. How I define fake news is false information, whether for whatever purpose, but that it might come to us from social media or popular culture. It often operates outside the information system of journalism. What I'm calling fake news is, I think, more dangerous. It's the appropriation of the guise of professionalized journalism based on understood standards, the appropriation of that guise to push stuff that is deceptive, often that's opinionated or that is partisan or advocacy of some sort. But it uses the language of objectivity and professional verification. It calls itself, for instance, fair and balanced, as Fox News used to do.
That saying seems to ring a bell.
Yeah, exactly. And if you look at a lot of the very clearly partisan advocacy organizations in the public sphere now, you look at Fox News, you look at Project Veritas, you look at Breitbart, you look at Daily Caller, and most of them have statements that say, we are accurate, we are verified, if we make mistakes, let us know, we'll publish corrections. They hide behind that language in order to present stuff that sounds like and feels like journalism to people who want to believe it. But it is in fact, fake news.
These terms and defining them and separating the two is so useful because obviously they get so lumped together. And I would say there's rarely a day in anyone who's listening to this lives where one of the two of those terms don't come up. But this is obviously not the first period where fake news and fake journalism have existed. When in the U.S. did these terms sort of enter our lexicon, whether they were named or they were just ideas that people were aware of?
Well, an understanding of the possibility of fake news has been around as long as there has been journalism in America. Mm. The very first newspaper in the English North American colonies, Public Occurrences, comes out in 1690. Published by somebody who comes over from London, a guy named Ben Harris, who sets up as a journalist and needs to persuade people. No one has ever seen a hometown journalist before in the colonies. So he's there, he's got to persuade people, look at me, trust me, I'm telling you the truth. So he comes out with this newspaper. He says, I'm going to look, if anybody gives me false reports, I'm going to expose them. I'm going to use only the best sources. I mean, he sounds like a responsible professional journalist. And then he publishes a little piece that says that King Louis XIV of France is sleeping with his daughter-in-law. Which he was not, because he didn't have a daughter-in-law. But it seemed to me that Ben Harris, the publisher of this newspaper, was a committed Protestant. Louis XIV was a Catholic who was persecuting Protestants in France. Mm. I think that Ben Harris figured this little tidbit of gossip, I don't care if it's true or not, it says something bad about this awful guy who's persecuting Protestants. And it says something bad about that people will believe. Because he's a papist, he's a king, he was known to have a licentious life, they'll believe it, doesn't matter.
It's close enough.
It's close enough, yeah. So there's been that from the beginning. But there was a real debate using the word faking that I found really interesting. In the 1880s, 1890s, some journalists, up until then, there were really no rules for journalism. There was no conventions, there was no codes of ethics. People had an idea that you should tell the truth, but newspapers also did things like they published tall tales and hoaxes and humbugs, and it was up to the reader to figure it out. or they didn't really know what was true. So they would use a headline, a standard headline over a piece that was sort of unverifiable. They would say, important if true, which of course meant that, you know, if it was not true, it was trivial. But by around the late 19th century, a lot of them were talking about faking as something they loved to do because it made their audiences, their readers happy. If you look at trade, there are new trade journals coming out in the 1880s, and one of them says, faking is not exactly lying. It's embellishing a story. It's giving it a little bit of snap and sparkle. It won't hurt anybody. People will like it. And reporters enjoyed doing that. It gave them a little creativity. So the word is being used in this time. And this is when what I call real journalism arises, in part as a reaction against those fakers. Real journalism, one of the earliest practitioners who attempted to set standards was Adolf Oakes with his New York Times, which he bought in 1896. There's an idea that journalism is not serving the public good, that it's not trustworthy, that the faking is giving it a bad name, that the yellow press is way too sensational. So some newspapers start to try to set standards and to identify themselves as the journalists who do not fake.
Were these newspapers that did set standards more or less successful financially?
Oh, that's a really good question. The most successful newspapers are always the ones that push the boundaries and are a little sensational and a little deceptive and a little fake. Yeah. The Hearst and Pulitzer Yellow Press of the 1890s always outsold the New York Times by a lot. In the 1920s, the tabloids, the Daily News, reached 1 million, the first newspaper in America to reach 1 million circulation. So, yeah, people always like that. It's entertaining. It's interesting. It doesn't take a lot of time out of your life. It doesn't eat your attention. Yeah.
Well, it just goes to show you that this tension between the business side of journalism and the capital J side of journalism has existed long before the period of time that we are currently in. And hearing you talk about that era gives me shivers up my spine, and I think it may be a little bit of PTSD for what it has been like to be a journalist over the last 6 years.
Yeah.
And I think it's both been the heyday of being a journalist and I think a really terrible period to be a journalist, because you are constantly on the defense about the work that you do, because for 50% of the country, you are told that you are making it up, that it is fake news, that you are liberal media with an agenda. And I think some of that is true for some journalists, and for many, many, many journalists, for every colleague that I've ever worked with. We try really hard. We're trying harder than ever to get it right and to be down the middle. And I think hearing you talk about the roots of that really just set off every alarm bell in my brain of everything that I've been fighting against.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. And that's the real danger of fake journalism, is that it shadows real journalism. The ones who use the language and the guise of real journalism and betray it, make it all the harder for real journalists to do their really important, essential work.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, In Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
When I was at journalism school, it was 2011, 2012, and my classmates and I think this was slightly post-recession, but still sort of felt recession-y, and the news business was changing so much. It was really shifting over. For the first time, it felt like print was having a very, very tough time, and digital was everything, but it still hadn't figured out how to be profitable in any way, shape, or form. So it was very, very difficult time to get a job in journalism.
Yeah.
Very. And so basically our whole year of the program was spent talking about that. But I would imagine now for students who are at the journalism school, so much of the focus must be on exactly what you're talking about. I think that the problem of journalism today is fake news and fake journalism and misinformation. Is that right?
Yeah. There's a lot of interest in misinformation, disinformation, a lot of anxiety, a lot of tension. Yeah. And it's a really hard world out there for people who want to do good work in journalism. It's the kind of places where when I started teaching at the J School in 1998, people would graduate and they would go work on, you know, metro newspapers. That just doesn't happen. It's harder and harder to find the sort of place that lets you do the really important work.
Well, that I think is entirely true. And because there are aren't very many places where you can do the very important work anymore. I also think for readers, it's a really tough time to figure out how you get news down the middle. I hear all the time from very, very smart people, I don't know where to get my news right now. And I think part of that is because there are a few places to get your news, and also because even the good places to get your news have been demonized. How, in a historical context, I would imagine this is not the first time where people have high feelings of distrust in the media. Are there other times that you can think of where this has played out? And I'm curious if we can take a lesson for those times about how to get out of them.
Yeah, I've been looking for lessons. It's really hard. There are times. There have been some times when everything just spirals up and ratchets up to such a fever pitch that a pin comes along and sticks and it all kind of blows out. I'm thinking of the Yellow Press in the Spanish-American War in 1898, when Pulitzer and Hearst just egged each other on and the spiral of sensationalism just kept ratcheting up and up and up, because if one found a story, the other had to find a bigger story and the other had to find a more sensational story. And then at one point, Hearst's paper published a little poem, a stupid little poem saying something about it would be not so terrible if the president was assassinated. And less than a year later, the president was. Mm. McKinley was assassinated. And then nobody said that it was Hearst who had caused the assassination. The assassin didn't even read English. But the point was that it made everybody stop and take a deep breath and go, oh, this is wrong. This is bad. We got to stop. And one of my theories is that this is why Joseph Pulitzer then established the Columbia Journalism School, because he was so embarrassed at the excesses he had countenanced in the circulation battle. And when everybody stepped back and took a breath, it became very clear. So sometimes it takes a kind of a crisis like that. I hate, though, to wait around for a big enough crisis to help, you know, move journalism along.
Well, also, kind of, haven't we been living in the biggest crisis of this for the last
yes.
5 years?
Yeah. Yes, and sometimes I think if this isn't a big enough crisis to stop it, you know, I can't imagine what is.
God, I don't want to wait around to find out what's worse than what's been happening over the last stretch of time. I hate to even bring it up, but we kind of got there. I feel like we have to talk about Donald Trump's role in this. But obviously, in the election of 2016 and then 2020 when he was president, but it dates back way further than that. You write about this in your book, to his role in the birther movement in President Obama's term. So we have to address him and who he is in the history of fake news and fake journalism.
Yeah, he is a prime mover, and it you know, I am just as baffled as so many people I know to explain this phenomenon of a man who can be so blatantly, pugnaciously mendacious and have it work, have it accepted. He's speaking to people, to voters, to Americans who have a vision of what they believe the country to be, and they have not seen that vision reflected elsewhere. In many ways, it's an inaccurate or warped or distorted vision, which is why it's not reflected elsewhere. But along comes Trump and makes them feel validated. And it's really hard to tell people that something they desperately want to believe is not true. Mm. And he's been very good at telling people the things they desperately want to believe are true, better than anyone else I've seen in my historical research.
Well, part of that is that he is a very effective communicator in the way that he communicates, whether we like what he's communicating or not.
Yeah.
And then you also have a two-pronged thing that is helping him. You have an institution like Fox News and you have social media. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you can talk to me about both of those two entities and where they fit in historically. I know that these are in many ways similar and in many ways different than the kinds of platforms that people had in other times that sort of mirror where we are today.
Yeah. Now, I think that Trump has certainly been empowered and enabled by more traditional media like Fox News. I say it more traditional because it is a cable television rather than social media, but also social media has had an enormous influence and Trump has been very good at using it, at manipulating it. This intimate relationship between a political figure and journalistic organizations is, well, I won't say unprecedented. Nothing is really unprecedented, but it is a much, much stronger and more powerful connection than I've seen in the past. There have been newspapers that have been very powerfully on the side of a political figure. I think of the Chicago Tribune in the 1930s and 40s when it hated Franklin Roosevelt, hated him passionately. And that was a powerful newspaper. But I don't think it had the kind of reach and influence that Fox News, for instance, has. And social media are just... It's difficult to categorize or characterize because I don't think we have seen anything like the ubiquity, the speed, the cheapness of it. It is so easy. It used to be if you wanted to really broadcast your ideas, you needed some kind of platform that cost you money. You can now just, you know, buy a phone. And if you've got a phone, you can tell millions of people anything you want.
You could go to the library and use it. You don't even have to spend a dollar. There's no barrier to entry.
That's true. That's true. And that is something that is new and very frightening and raises all sorts of questions that lag way behind the effects. The questions are, for instance, many people who have not studied journalism, who don't know a lot about how journalism works, they say, well, why can't you just regulate it? Why can't you just forbid it? Why can't you just, you know, stop these from publishing? It's really difficult to explain that you know, the legal traditions of the First Amendment and freedom of speech, all of this is in play here. People want to say, well, you know, cut it down. If it's wrong, cut it down. And it's never been really unconstitutional to say things that are wrong.
Sure. Well, then in that vein, I'm wondering what you think of Twitter's decision to deplatform President Trump.
Really fascinating, is what I think. Yeah, yeah. I think it was private company making a decision that it was a very brave decision. It was a very important decision. And I think it has certainly diminished Trump's voice among his followers, although he's now finding other ways. He's setting up his new social network, doesn't seem to be doing that well. It was a moment when he had the power and the voice at the same time. He's kind of lost that.
I don't think that I really understood how powerful Twitter was until he was deplatformed because you instantly cut off oxygen to him. You had no way to hear from him directly. Not only did you not hear from him directly, you kind of didn't hear from him indirectly because his tweets every time he sent one was covered. It was on front page of newspapers. It was the top story on every cable news network. And so he knew that the platform was going to set things off and get coverage, and whatever he said was going to be covered for days on end. And without that, he was gone. He was missing it. Really just shows you the power of these platforms and how that they became the place where news and news agendas were set.
Yeah, yeah. And there have been powerful platforms in the past, but nothing like this. Nothing with this kind of immediate reach. And it also raised a lot of questions for journalists when he was on Twitter, when he was using Twitter so powerfully. As you said, do you really have to put it on the front page of the newspaper every time?
Right.
Do you cover it all the time like that? Do you give him that much amplification of the oxygen he already has? And that was a serious debate that that journalists would, you know, flying to screaming matches about how to handle that kind of news.
I was sometimes in those screaming matches, so I understand.
and if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker, to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
One thing that I will give credit to social media for is the fact that if you see something on Fox News, if you see something in another news outlet that you want to call out, you now have the ability to do so now. And until social media was prevalent, you couldn't really do anything about the news that was false or fake journalism. You had no recourse for calling out the powers that be. Is that right?
Yeah, but less recourse. You could always write a letter to the editor, and maybe you would be one of the, you know, several thousand who didn't, who would be picked out of the several thousand and be published. But I don't know. Part of the problem with social media is it's so easy to stay in your own bubble and not to see. It's very easy not to see how other organizations are going to call out news that I agree with and challenge that. It's very easy to find confirmation of what I want to believe, and I really have to work hard if I'm going to challenge myself to look at stuff I'm questioning.
We're talking a lot about journalism and about fake journalism, but I want to just touch on this moment in fake news that we're witnessing. I think primarily of all the information around vaccines and vaccination right now. And of course, that's not new to COVID. Disinformation, misinformation around anti-vax sentiment has been around for a long time, but I think because for the first time we're having mass vaccination, you're really seeing it in the masses. Mm-hmm. How does something like this spread and gain traction? Put this in a little bit of historical context.
Yeah, well, as you say, there have been controversies over vaccines before. In one of the first newspaper battles in 1721, something like that, two newspapers took opposite sides about whether smallpox vaccination was good, and they used language like, "This is false. You're lying. You're telling untruths about what the vaccines do." So it's always been a very fraught issue. People who look at it as only a public health issue or only a medical issue are really losing sight of the emotion that drives this. So it's like politics. It is as emotionally fraught as politics, and it gets people as anxious and as angry and as divided as politics can, especially since it is so explicitly now linked to partisan politics, that for some people, refusing vaccines is a statement on behalf of Trump or others on the right. So it's so similar to the way that political partisanship has taken over the social media discourse.
It's so fascinating to hear you talk about the roots of it. And I hate to ask for a prescription for how to go forward, because I know that there's not an answer. But I also know that you are the most studied, wise person on the topic. So I'll ask you a series of questions about how we move forward. I won't ask you the big overarching 30,000-foot question.
Okay.
I get asked a lot, and I have one conversation in my head that for now literally years has stuck out to me. A very dear friend's mother was trying to decide whether or not she wanted to vote for President Trump or now President Biden. And she didn't know where to get her news from because she didn't trust the New York Times or people like the papers like the New York Times. She didn't trust Fox News, and she felt helpless. She felt at a loss. She felt like there was nowhere for her to turn. And I do not think she is alone in that, both in people who really don't understand the media landscape and people who really do understand the media landscape. I think everyone is sort of at a frustrating point with the state of journalism. So what do you tell people who are frustrated, who don't know where to turn, who don't know where to look? How do we get back to an era of both trusting news and of telling news in a way that seems more like calling balls and strikes?
Oh, that is the hardest question in the world. But absolutely critical for the future of public life and democracy. I mean, there are the things, the standard things you tell people about how to evaluate the credibility of a news source. People who ask how do I know whether to trust it? I give them a checklist of things to look for. Is this a news organization that has editors who will scrutinize or supervise the final copy? Is this a news organization that, if it makes a mistake, will acknowledge it and publish a correction? Is it a news organization that is independent or has some kind of financial relationship that you should know about? I mean, those are all standard things. It doesn't answer the existential question of how do I trust this again? And, you know, This is sort of where I'm tempted to say I'm a historian. I don't know how to solve current problems. I just look at them. But I think that one aspect that troubles me a lot is, for many good reasons, the whole idea, the professional journalistic ideal of objectivity, has come under strong challenge in the mainstream press. For good reasons, as I say, there is an understanding that it often is misapplied. There's a misunderstanding about what objectivity really means, which in its original form in the 1920s simply meant scrutinizing facts like a scientist, testing your assumptions, stepping back, rigorously verifying. It did not require that you say on the one hand, on the other hand, and go home. It did not require that you hide all emotions or deny you had emotions. It meant that you recognized them and tested your information so that you would feel comfortable and your readers would feel comfortable that they had all the information they needed, even if it was information that the reporter, him or herself, didn't necessarily believe.
Well, I think that that's a really good point that you bring up, because we've been in such a hypersensitive time where it's always impossible for everyone to completely have no opinion about anything or no thought about anything that's happening in the world. I think about the hearings that we're having for the new Supreme Court justice. And I heard her say earlier this week in those insane hearings, she was asked about her opinion on something. And she said, well, of course I have opinions. I'm a person. I have thoughts, but that's not how I perform my job. And I think it rang so true to me as a journalist too. You can't rid yourself of all human emotion and rational thought. And I think part of the problem over the last 6 years, or part of the problem that I've been having over the last 6 years, is that there's right and left, and then there's right and wrong, right? And I think that when things got to a point where they were so blatantly wrong, having nothing to do with partisanship, it was my personal belief that you were allowed to call that out, because there's some objectivity to being able to say something is wrong. I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, I do to a certain extent. Absolutely, it is silly to try to find, you know, somebody to balance out your claim that climate change is dangerous. That's completely unnecessary.
That children in cages, you're allowed to say this is not right.
Yeah. There are certain things that seem self-evidently factual. My concern is that many of the mainstream media are backing off from the claim that they can report objectively, because there are valid questions about, or what does neutral mean? Whose standpoint is neutral? But the more that the mainstream media are acknowledging and flaunting sometimes their own subjectivity, as long as they are claiming the right to make judgments, as you know, to be transparent about their feelings, that's fine. That is persuasive. On the other hand, you've got the empire of right-wing media saying, we're not biased. We're completely objective. We're verifying everything. So you've got, on the one hand, the people who are saying we have the truth. And on the other side, you have the people who are doing the hard work of journalism, but they're saying, well, this is that we have to be transparent. This is coming out of this certain place.
You're talking about the way that Republicans and Democrats communicate basically right now.
Well,
and that's why Republicans are always
so
successful, because they just are where they are. They don't apologize for it. And they are more comfortable being less truthful. And Democrats apologize for who they are all the time.
And mainstream journalists apologize for having feelings. And that, you know, that undermines and diminishes the factual evidence they have collected, and one likes to think that they have subjected, you know, committed to the process of verification and understanding. I'm not so sure that ditching objectivity or the language of objectivity for the mainstream media is really going to help.
Well, this is entirely fascinating. And this conversation is why I encourage everyone to pick up your book. It is a really fascinating, rich, historical understanding of where we are today. I feel like I gained so much wisdom and my understanding of the situation that I have been thinking about and talking about for the last 6 years ad nauseum is so much richer because of you. And I'm so grateful for you writing it and for you stopping by here today. You were just a true wealth and fountain of wisdom, and I'm so grateful for it.
Oh, thank you. And this has been a great conversation. I love talking about this. I feel much more interesting now that I've written this book, because people are so interested in the topic. But thank you for a great conversation.
Thank you to our guest, Andy Tucker, and of course, my co-host, Joe Hagan, who's off this week. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13, and of course, our great producer, Brett Fuchs. And of course, I also want to thank our sponsors. Please support them any way you would support this podcast. We'll see you right here next week.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.